Early on, I used to use a telescope, and I'd go like this, and then the telescope would then dissolve into make-believe. I just remembered that. That's a long time ago. But I wanted the children to see that everything in reality was real. So I show them the underneath the switch that makes the trolley work. Of course, once it goes to make-believe, then anything can happen. I mean, King Friday can come down in a parachute, as he did last week.
Okay, let's talk a little about the land of make-believe within the show, how it works with what you've been talking about in the beginning of the show.
Yes, I really feel that the opening reality of the program, we deal with the stuff that dreams are made of. And then in the neighborhood of make-believe, we deal with it as if it were a dream. And then when it comes back to me, we deal with the simple interpretation of the dream. That sounds very analytical, and it probably doesn't show at all, and that's fine, I hope it doesn't. But that's at least when I'm writing the script, that's what I think about. And that anything can happen in make-believe, and we can talk about anything in reality. Margaret used to say, whatever is mentionable is manageable. And I hope the children can get that from our work.
Let's talk about some of those mentionable things that you wouldn't necessarily think of as mentionable. You did a special when Robert Kennedy was assassinated.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, we stayed up all night. That, again, was... I think we did that live. I'm not sure. I think we did that for the network live. At any rate, there had been too many things. The country was in deep grief. I mean, President Kennedy had been killed, then Martin Luther King was killed, and then Robert Kennedy. And I said, I've got to talk to the families. And so, as I remember, the theme of that program was my saying to the parents, the best thing you can do is to include your children in your own ways of dealing with grief. Because your children will know anyway, without your saying anything, how you're feeling. So please, if it's going to church or a synagogue, or if it's going for a walk along a stream, whatever your way of dealing with grief is, please include your children. That was the main plea. And a lot of people felt that was helpful. You know, to actually say, here we are, you know, we're a country in grief. Now, we can, as a community, work through it.
And you did something very similar in the 80s with Ronald Reagan and the Pope and John Lennon after they faced assassination attempts, and Lennon's case was killed. You went on and did a similar program?
I forgot that. Yeah. I do remember making the public service announcement for the war.
The Gulf War?
The Gulf War, yeah. And it, again, I think it was a plea for parents to to allow their children to know that they would do everything they could to keep their children safe. Because that's what children would be concerned about. There was all of this stuff on television about people getting killed and, you know, people in the direst of straits with visages that were tortured. And I understand that. I mean, I understand why that would need to be shown. But if children happen to see that, they could be frightened terribly. So, in fact, news programs are probably the most frightening programs for anybody. But what I wanted the parents to know was that invariably, when children see something like that, their first thought will be, what will happen to me? So, you know, whether we could be absolutely sure of this fact or not, we need to say it. I will take care of you. We need to say it.
So the same would be true on the shows that you've done on divorce?
Oh, sure. You know, my mother used to say, a long time ago, whenever there would be any really catastrophe that was in the movies or on the air, she would say, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers, you know, even just on the sidelines. That's why I think that if news programs could make a conscious effort of showing rescue teams, of showing who medical people, anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy, to be sure that they include that. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
You also did a show on death.
Mm-hmm. One of my goldfish died, and I wanted the children to know that I had feelings about that kind of separation. And while you can't get very close to a goldfish, it can remind you of something or someone that you were close to. And so that's why I talked about my dog, Mitzi, and when she died, and how I cried, and how my grandmother comforted me. No, it's just a matter of being honest with the children and whoever happens to be watching with the children. But if you had told me, for instance, 25 years ago, that I would have done a whole week on divorce, for instance, or on child care, I would have thought, that's beyond my belief, beyond my ken. But divorce is so prevalent, and if you're not affected directly, you're certainly affected indirectly in school or on the playground. So we did do a whole week about divorce. And Prince Tuesday was very concerned because his mother and dad were angry with each other that they were going to get a divorce. And that was how it was dealt with in make-believe. But then we had some real instances in reality. And then child care, I mean, many children nowadays are participating in child care who weren't 25 years ago.
And what is the major concern of a child about child care?
Well, being taken, and will somebody come and get them? And what happens when their parents leave them? And do their parents think about them while they're gone? And is it all right to think about their parents themselves when the parents are gone? That kind of thing.
Have you ever talked about television?
Just last week, we did a program in which I read a book, actually, that I had. I took the children to the library and showed them how books are taken out of the library, showed them some of the things that happen in a library, like a man teaching chess and another man helping children with crafts. And I love this library. It's the Homewood Library in Pittsburgh. It's just wonderful. At any rate, they could see that I love the library. But the book that was involved in that program was called The Day the TV Broke. And it's this whole book, a picture book, about what happens when the TV breaks and the little boy is very glum, nothing to do. Well, of course, what happens is that he finds all of these things to do. His father carts the TV set away, brings it back at the end of the week, and the kid is too busy with other things to even look at it right away. Wonderful theme, you know. In fact, Our grandsons, we have two grandsons, and they're at the summer place where there is no television. This is a house that we've had for 40 years, and I said, there's one thing that we must never have in the house, and that's television. And so they're there, and ordinarily they watched a lot of television at home. I heard from their mother that they're not missing it at all. You know, they're doing lots of other things. And that's a great lesson for us. We don't have to have this sound and picture 24 hours a day. If I could just get people, you know, just turn off the neighborhood, turn off whatever's there, and play. You know, use this, the best of all.
You've done a number of shows on demystifying television, even your show.
Sure. I've said to the cameras, please pull back and show that this is a set. And I walk right off the porch and off into the studio and show the little model. And people like that. People like... somebody said to me, why do you suppose that people have watched The Neighborhood for so long? I said, people love honesty. They like to be in touch with those who are honest and real. Don't you? I mean, don't you like to be with real people, the people who aren't afraid to make mistakes and people who just know that life is a gift and relish in it? Yeah.
Let's talk about mistakes for a moment. If you make a mistake while you're filming, do you sometimes leave them in?
Mm-hmm. You may have seen the program in which Sylvia Earle came and showed. We were going to demonstrate to the children this aqua sound thing. I wanted to show the children how fish actually make noise underwater, because of course it's not anything we hear. So Sylvia put, you know who Sylvia Earle is? She's the sort of the present Jacques Cousteau. She's the last word when it comes to underwater stuff. In fact, we're going to tape with her probably in either September or October in these submergibles. They're just individual submarines. So we'll have... she'll be in one and I'll be in the next and we'll be going along. Anyway, she came and we put this thing into the tank and you couldn't hear a thing. The fish weren't speaking, I guess. And so we went through it and she said, well, that's that. And I knew that later in the program I had a film about it anyway. So I just said, well, sometimes things just don't work. And she said, yeah, that's right. And so we ended the scene and people said, well, I guess you want to do that again. And I said, no, I don't. I want the children to see that even with adults, sometimes it doesn't work out the way you planned. So that's in the program. fish don't make any sounds.
Let's talk about music. We've sort of talked about it, but how is music incorporated into the show? Aside from the songs, you have the background music. You have a lot of music.
We do. It has a musical grid, this neighborhood. It's sort of the heartbeat of it all. I don't know what I would do without music. Well, I never have to be without music now because I have it here. I mean, even if I would go deaf or something, I'd always have it. But it's just such an integral part of my being that to be able to create with it is... I wonder if you're born that way. I mean, my grandfather McFeely loved to play the fiddle. In fact, I remember when there was a song that he played. It was called "Play Gypsy, Dance Gypsy, Play While You May," and he played that on the fiddle. I'll never forget the first time I was able to play the piano with him. Oh, I must have been maybe 8 when I learned that. I think that's why my wife loves 2 piano work, because chamber music is much more fun than solo. To make music with somebody else, you know? I can see why people would love being a part of an orchestra. Yo-Yo Ma and Van Cliburn and all of these, Itzhak Perlman, and all of these people who have so generously come and given their talents, you know, on the neighborhood. It delights me to be able to offer that to children. And I hope they delight in receiving it. But I know a little boy in Chicago. He was 4 years old and he saw Yo-Yo for the first time on our program. And he said, "I want to do that." Well, his parents thought, you know, that'll pass. The next week, "I want a cello." So finally, he was so insistent about it that they got him some Suzuki lessons. His mother had to learn a little bit to help him practice. She's still playing. This was 6 or 7 years ago. She's still playing, and so is he. And that all happened because that child saw Yo-Yo loving what he was doing in front of him.
What about the transitional music in the show? Now, that's all done live. It's not recorded.
Mm-hmm. Michael, or Johnny first, and now Michael, would pick up themes from the songs and elaborate on those themes. And as we go along the model of the neighborhood, there would be just enough music to get me from one place to another, and then in we go. I mean, when you think about it, the neighborhood is one great big composition, isn't it? And then, of course, when we do the operas, oh, what a good time we've had with them.
I'll talk about them.
Well, I was in school with John Reardon. He was at Rollins with us, and he later went to be part of the Metropolitan Opera Company. And he always enjoyed making up things with us. And so when we decided to, I just wanted to try the opera form. I mean, it's just, you know, musical form. And so I said, "Jack, would you consider taking a part in these little operas?" "Of course I would," he said. And so every time we'd do an opera, King Friday would say, "Reardon." I would like you to make an opera. And so Reardon would come and always take a part in them. And Windstorm and Bubbleland, for instance, Joe Negri said to me, I've never played a mean person before. He was W.I. Norton Donovan, and that stands for wind, W-I-N-D. And he was the wind trying to blow the bubbles away from Bubbleland. Well, you can tell. I like what we've done and what we do.
And you started out, when you first started out, the shows really could stand by themselves, and now you've gone into a five-show cycle on a theme, mm-hmm. which is, in a way, variations on a theme, and very musical in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to switch into the longer form like that?
I think I just like the idea that that a story can be, I mean, almost every day could stand on its own, but there is a resolution to the story in make-believe by the end of the week. And I like the idea that people might read just a chapter one night and then a chapter the next night and think about it a while. And I like to say to the children after a particular episode, now what do you think will happen? And how would you make it happen? Because you know you can write your own make-believe. You don't even need to use the same places or the same characters. You can make up your own. It's just always encouraging the children to recognize their own uniqueness. There is only one person in the whole world like you. That's the greatest gift you can give anybody, is the gift of your honest self. I mean, you've had a lot of courses, and you've probably taught courses in writing. You can teach that as a mechanical kind of thing, but there's no way that you would ever want everybody to write the same material. What you would want the most is for each person to tell his or her own story. That's what I want. I want the children to recognize that they have an important story to tell because, one, it's unique.
So when you film the five segments then for the Land of Make-Believe, do you film that at once? Or?
Mm-hmm. All of the Neighborhood of Make-Believes are done before we do the interiors. First of all, we do the visits. We go to the Ball Machine Factory or wherever we might go. Then we do all of the Neighborhoods of Make-Believe, and then we do all of the interiors, and then we edit them all together. Very different from doing that program early on that was all live, you know. But the sets are just too big to put up and take down. So we figure that for every minute that's on the air, there is at least an hour of production. That's just a rule of thumb. On some of the remotes, it's much more than that, of course. But that's an average. So every minute that you see, we've been producing for an hour. And that doesn't count the script writing and all of the telephone calls and all of the production meetings and all of that. It's just production. It looks so effortless, and that's the way it should look. But there's a lot of effort. There are some scenes that I'll do in my room, for instance, and every time we tape a scene, then I go and sit and look at it. And invariably, there might be something that I might do a scene seven times. I I just wanted to be comfortable and right. I was on a program one time in New York, and I was just a guest with somebody, and we looked at the scene that we had just taped, and I looked at it and I thought to myself, boy, is that awful. And the person who was in charge of the program said, that's fine, let's move on. And I thought, well, it wouldn't be like that back home. So I was just the guest.
What would prompt you to do a retake? Is it the wording? What is the most important thing to you that would prompt that?
I want something to be as clear as possible, unencumbered. And if, you know, there's sometimes that I feel that I'm clearer than others, and I usually say to Margie, the producer, let me try that once more. And so we do.
Let's talk a little bit about the people behind the scenes at Mr. Rogers.
Our producer is Margie Whitmer. She studied to be a school teacher. She's softly tough. She's a kind person, and yet very well disciplined. Doesn't want too much distraction in the studio. You know, it's a real temptation to open the doors of the studio when we're taping to every imaginable group of people. And we do have some Make-A-Wish guests who come, that is their wish, that they come and meet us. And they've been some of the most wonderful visits that I've had. Oh, my thing's upstairs, but I carry pictures around with me of some of the kids who have come to visit. There's some kids who have been autistic, some kids who aren't able to speak at all, who are in wheelchairs, and many severely challenged children and their families. And that's a very important part of my day is meeting them. They bring something that I don't know. The people who have the toughest time in this life inspire me so enormously. I mean, everybody has difficulties. Some are just more obvious than others. And many people who have exceedingly obvious difficulties are able to let us be more in touch with our own and share them. And so consequently, we become a community. And you probably want to change tapes.
That's right.